As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
As we were looking for names for this podcast, we were thinking a record-setting podcast in tribute to the Canucks' most recent record that they've set league-wide of blowing four multi-goal losses in four games to start the season, or the Sky is Falling podcast. Any of it is appropriate, and we could probably come up with some more colorful names in and around certain player performances as we go here, but oh my goodness, have we got things to talk about today, Harmondale?
I can't believe it. I remember, too, on the last episode, just sort of previewing this road trip, and we were talking about we don't even need this to be a winning road trip. Just win three games between these first five road games and the home opener against Buffalo. That's at 500, and that's a massive win. The one thing we were saying, just don't catastrophically implode out of the gate. And that's exactly what they've done somehow. I'm legitimately shell-shocked.
A catastrophic version of the VanCast. And look, so much to get into, but as our listeners know, because there's been plenty of hand-wringing for the last 24 hours, really for the last 3 days here, the Vancouver Canucks are 0-3-1 to start the season on their five-game road trip. Wow, Columbus was the latest. They once again had a two-goal lead. They gave that up. Had another one-goal lead. Gave that up before eventually succumbing in overtime. Spencer Martin with his first appearance for the Canucks. Ilya Mikheyev with his first appearance. Myers as well back in the lineup. Tucker Poolman back in the lineup as well for this team. So going into it, you thought there was a lot to get excited about because they were finally slowly starting to get healthy. And there's so much to dive into as far as those players, their performance, the Connor Garland situation, the Jack Rathbone situation. There's a lot to dive into, but we can't start without talking about like four consecutive blown leads after game three. Bruce Boudreau said this team is mentally weak after game three. These guys had a players-only meeting. Who does that after three games?
And it hasn't helped. Record.
And that's another record. And it hasn't helped. Like, and you know, I read your article in The Athletic about just the game and kind of recapping where they are. And you know, you make a good point because when you compare these losses to how they looked a year ago at this time, and in the previous two incarnations of bad starts, there's been a lot to like, but at the critical moments, they just don't have it in them.
Yeah, it's different from the last two poor starts because the team isn't getting blown out and looking completely hopeless and completely lacking structure. The difference here is, I think the best way to describe it is they're completely lacking basic professionalism in their game right now because that's what it takes to sort of close out leads and win a lot of these hockey games. It's collectively, the analogy that I kind of drew is, it's like watching a promising non-superstar rookie playing his first NHL games, right? Like you see the exciting flashes where you see a lot of positives and the player kind of takes over in some moments, but then the elementary cardinal sin type mistakes that you just can't forgive just keep rearing their ugly head. And when one mistake happens, they don't know how to handle the pressure and that adversity. And so it snowballs, it unravels rookie's confidence until he's benched. Like that's a feeling I get from this entire team watching them play. Like, professionalism is about nailing the basics and fundamentals of things like puck management and defending the front of the net. And through these first four games, the Canucks have had some decent performances, but they've never had a professional, polished showing from beginning to end. And professionalism, it doesn't necessarily even mean outplaying your opponent over an entire game. It just means you bend rather than break when the other team is pushing. Because before that Columbus game, I think you could make an argument that the Canucks have had more good periods than they've had bad periods, right? Like, they were really solid at 5-on-5 against the Oilers. The last two periods were great against the Flyers. The first two periods against Washington were very good. The difference is, when Vancouver pushes, the other team can weather the storm and limit the damage. When other teams push, they give up three or four goals in a period. And look, mistakes will happen, right? They're inevitable. But the Canucks are making the egregious ones that I mean, it's just like you look at them and you're like, if that was a rookie making that mistake, he'd get benched on the spot.
Or Connor Garland.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing. Well, we'll talk about the Garland thing, but it's not even like I didn't even think that he'd done much to warrant a scratch. But I mean, you just think back to the tying goals in all of these games and the events that kind of led up to it, right? In Edmonton, it was Darnell Nurse who tied it up shorthanded. And that play was Pettersson trying to get to Horvat in the bumper. And look, turnover will happen. The turnover was not the problem. The problem on that sequence, the unforgivable part about it, was that Horvat had a 50-50 battle. He lost the battle. Again, that's fine. He needed to back check and chase Nurse. But for some reason, he kind of just spun off balanced, despite there being no real strong physical contact. And he didn't back check at all. And it became an uncontested 3-on-1. And it was Nurse, obviously, who capitalized, who Horvat otherwise should have been able to catch on the back check if he had just kept skating. Right? You think back to the Philadelphia James Van Riemsdyk. Again, it was another shorthanded goal for the opposition. It was this horrific JT Miller pass at the offensive blue line, trying to thread the needle, where it's just like there's no understanding of risk to reward management there. I showed the screenshot in my article from yesterday. There were three Flyers right around him. In Washington, Noah Juulsen, two turnovers. And it wasn't just the Juulsen turnovers. In the 4-on-4 sequence, it was so frustrating watching them. They have the lead and they're trying these drop passes in 4-on-4, risky drop pass, one after the other. They were playing with fire. You could see that blown lead coming a mile away. And then against Columbus, that Werenski tying goal, the initial one that made it 2-2, you had four guys, four Canucks jerseys below the hash marks. How do you not have a single guy defending the front of the net?
It's bad. It's bad on so many levels. And that's the whole point, right? Is we're not talking about you know, we're talking about careless moments, right? It's not even a case of the dam is building and eventually it's going to break. It's not even that. It's just such a level of carelessness at key times in games. And sometimes you don't know it was a key time until it's happened, right? And that's the hard part, is that these guys are having a tough time of managing the moment, of reading the room, as it were, right? And, you know, when you get into a certain time in the game and you get to a certain point with the lead, like, this is how you have to play. And that doesn't mean you've got to play cautious, but you've just got to tighten up and you've got to be smarter and you've got to be dialed in on details. And this team right now just doesn't have it in them. You know, I'm surprised when it happens with Bo Horvat, because he generally has a level of hockey sense and he's not the guy that falls in those moments, right? I'm not telling you he's a 1C. I'm not telling you he's a, you know, an elite player or anything like that. But generally, he's not the guy making the mental error, the effort error in that moment. So when you talk about that earlier in the trip, yeah, like, that stands out. Whereas JT Miller, we've become far too accustomed to it now. And it's impossible not to look at, and I don't want to fully digress into one player right now, but it's impossible to not look at the continued mistakes he makes and not look at that contract. Like, oh my God.
It hasn't even kicked in yet.
It hasn't even kicked in yet. And, you know, we've just gotten through a Louis Erickson contract. And look, there's always going to be more offensive upside with JT Miller. But oh my goodness, right? Like, the stuff that he does in his own end, when he talks specifically about not wanting to puck watch, right? That I need to do a better job of not puck watching in the defensive end. And then we saw the play last night where he did it again. And it's, you know, I commented to Jason Brough. I commented, this is like Jake Virtanen level of defensive awareness. Like, that's what it is. And, you know, we want to believe that JT Miller is a player that has a level of hockey sense, that he's got hockey IQ. But boy, I'm telling you, like when you see the passes at the blue line that turn into turnovers and you see all of those moments, like, does he? Yes, he's got offensive talent, but does he have hockey IQ?
Especially when it comes to playing center. Center is a demanding position from a defensive standpoint. In your own end, you're essentially functioning as a third defenseman is the way that I've had players kind of describe it to me in the past. And that's where Miller just doesn't seem to have that instinctual awareness of the right guy to pick up, the right reads to make. And even when it came to, for example, that tying goal, I think the Werenski one, mistake there was Mikheyev, because he was kind of initially, he was actually in the perfect spot to defend the net front. And he, for whatever reason, him and Stillman both doubled up on trying to chase Goudreau below the goal line. But even when that initial breakdown happened, and I think it was Jenner who had the puck from Goudreau right around the blue paint, OEL was going for Jenner. Miller closed in on him as well. And instead, if Miller had just in that moment been able to see that, okay, OEL's going to try and close on Jenner here, that I should maybe get the back door with Werenski instead, like that would have prevented the goal as well. And you're just seeing a lot of these little, I can't even call them little, you're seeing a lot of these mistakes add up. And look, this is really going to test. The one thing I'm curious to see is I think this is going to be a big test of his mental evolution and maturity. When I wrote that Miller story last season, and I kind of dug in on his early career and why he was such an inconsistent player, the biggest thing that teammates and coaches would consistently bring up is that Miller so hardened himself that he self-destructs when things start to go wrong, that one mistake becomes two, one bad game becomes two, and it just snowballs and snowballs. I mean, Ryan Callahan in Tampa would say that he'd constantly have to sit with JT on the bench and tell him to stop beating himself up and tell him to just move on and turn a fresh page. But JT's just so kind of wired and it's just like he can't move on once he makes a mistake. And Derek Lalonde, who was the assistant coach in Tampa, now coaches Detroit, the way he put it is that with JT, what used to happen is that he'd make one bad play and then he'd feel the need to immediately make up for it. And then that's why he sort of ends up forcing plays and making more mistakes, right? So it's like, let's say there's a blown assignment defensively and it leads to a goal against. Miller's tendency in the past has been, all right, like he feels so bad that I've got to make this up immediately. And then he starts forcing passes and turning the pucks over at the offensive blue line and it just spirals out of control. So I'm going to be really curious to see if he can turn a fresh page mentally. Like how much has he really evolved in that sense? And the thing too is, it's not just that Miller has been bad offensively, but his line is generating nothing offensively at 5-on-5. Like we're talking about nearly 55-on-5 minutes that he's played. And based on the chances that he's generated on the ice, his line has less than one expected goal, right? Like they're not, it's not even that. Like for example, in the 2021 season, we kind of saw like when there was a whole North Division shades of this defensively as well, where we were talking about, okay, all these turnovers and he's not playing well defensively, but he was still generating a lot offensively, at least it seemed to offset some of the defensive woes. And we're just not even seeing that right now. It's hard for me to think about a stretch in a game where that Miller line has consistently sort of hemmed a team in its own end and looked consistently dangerous the way, for example, the Pedersen line has, or even the way Horvat's line has now started to get rolling.
Yeah, but someone's going to have to explain to me, like at some point, Harm, they're paying this guy to be a center. They're paying him to be a top six center. And at the end of the day, there are so many flaws in that. Like he's got to get moved back to wing.
And yeah, that's just what I was about to say.
Well, yeah, but can they do that given what they're paying him? And can they do that given the way the rest of this roster is constructed? Because they got a bunch of 4Cs, and one of those guys is going to have to get elevated if you want to do this. And none of them are good enough for that. So it just makes me scratch my head that the way they've set their roster up and the way they've set their salary structure up, they're going to continue with this experiment for a long period of time here, right? And, you know, I equate it to a quarterback, right? Like, you know, a quarterback's got to be able to put the pick behind him, right? Like, if you throw a pick, you've got to be able to throw the next one. Some guys will get a little bit conservative. And you almost wish JT Miller would do that and not be so willing to throw the next one. You know, and to dial it back a little bit. But when you look at what he doesn't do as a creative player and as a puck distributor, you know, we talk about that with Bo Horvat, that he's not a guy that can create, right? He can drive a line, but he can't really make his wingers better, right? He can't generate points for them that way. You know, he can drive it different ways by going to the net. And ultimately, you know, so people have talked before about, you know, what is he? Is he, you know, he's always been a center here, but there have been people who've thought, oh, maybe Bo Horvat should go play the wing. And that's just never going to happen at this stage of his career. But in JT Miller's case, you know, you can still describe the center situation as a question and it being an experiment, even though, you know, we've now seen it for the better part of a season going back to the COVID year. But the best of JT Miller will be if you take the defensive pressure off him. I've had centers tell me before that it is physically more demanding to play center because of that 200-foot nature of it, but it is mentally easier because you know who you've got to pick up. You're supposed to be the first back, and that clears up who you're going to wind up picking up in transition in the defensive end, and he hasn't figured that out yet, right? Because he's sleepwalking through that, whether it's in transition or whether the play is in their end. So yes, he should go. Like, the offensive upside isn't there, in my opinion, for him as a center in terms of being able to drive a line. You know, we know how many of his points he picked up last year on the power play. So if that's not there and he can't figure it out defensively, what are we doing here other than the fact that we paid him $8 million a year? And now they've got to wear that because they're paying him to be a center.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting sort of debate where I think you have to weigh both short and long-term incentives, because in the short term, there's no question in my mind that if you're trying to win a hockey game tomorrow, I think you have to move Miller to the wing. There's no way he's able to handle that defensive responsibility right now.
But on top of that, how much more valuable does that make Bo Horvat? And we're not even talking about Bo's play to this point. Bo is a center. He's been a center throughout his career, and he's going to stay at center. So now you've got a 1C in Pettersson. And if you all of a sudden make a decision that we've chosen Miller over Horvat and we're at some point going to move on from Horvat, your 2C should be a winger.
Yeah. No, that's exactly, I was exactly going to say, where it's like short term, yeah, it's the best move. But in the long term, it's a disaster if Miller can't play center, if he can't stick as a top six center on a winning team. I don't mean on a team that's middling. I mean on a team that is consistently able to make the playoffs and is a legit, at least dark horse contender. Can Miller be that sort of player, not for a stretch of games, not for half a season, but year in, year out for 7 or 8 years?
Wow. So many players to talk about as we continue on this episode of the VanCast. Also, a reminder to our listeners, tomorrow night, Thursday night, Thomas Drantz and I will have a VanCast post-game live room. It's going to happen around 8 p.m. Pacific, give or take a little bit. We'll give you more details on that as we go, but yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell right now as far as JT Miller's concerned, but I still want to dive into Quinn Hughes, Connor Garland, Thatcher Demko, and others when we come back.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Harm, let's get into Quinn Hughes. So we know that late in the preseason, he got some time off. He was ill. He's playing big minutes. Probably would have had more minutes two games ago if he wasn't out for 7 minutes with the, you know, getting some work done on him after the high stick that he took. For me, I understand the context. I understand the fact that Quinn Hughes is a number one defenseman on a team that has arguably two top four defensemen and a whole bunch of spare parts at the bottom of their defensive core. And even with Myers coming back and even with Poolman back, it is so flawed. So much is being asked of him. I get all of that. He hasn't been good enough. He hasn't been creative enough offensively. He hasn't helped the power play enough. He hasn't helped in transition enough. And defensively, I'm seeing a 2021 version of Quinn Hughes. Like, we saw a significant improvement in his defensive play last season over the previous year. He's playing less with Luke Shen right now, who he clearly needs, and he is not good enough defensively right now. And it's the whole thing, it's a problem.
Absolutely. And you have to hope that part of it is just he's coming off this illness, and in each of these games, he's played at least 27 minutes per night in three games and four nights. That's not an excuse because he hasn't been good enough, but you're hoping that that's the reason why he struggled out of the gate, and that as he becomes healthier and that as the schedule starts to lighten up and you end up back at home, that you can hopefully see him start to look like himself again. Because you're right, this team is going nowhere if Quinn Hughes looks the way he has through these first few games. And you nailed it. It's not just one specific area. It's a multitude of them. On breakouts, for example, skating to me looks fine, but his passing, it's funny because before this season, I was just thinking about how, for as much as we talk about Hughes' skating ability, how his stretch passing ability and how precise and accurate he is at being able to hit outlet passes consistently impressed me on a nightly basis, and I thought it was the most underrated part of his game. When I think back to his performance last season, his passing right now is a train wreck. It's totally uncharacteristic. I've been so surprised seeing it when he's behind a net and he's just finding sticks and he can't make plays through traffic, and it's just disrupting the flow of what's happening when he's on the ice. And you look at the numbers even, and then the Canucks are getting outshot by 13, outchanced by 10 at 5-on-5 when he's been on the ice.
Yeah.
That's your best defenseman. There's no way this team is going anywhere. And defensively, you kind of mentioned it. I've got to be honest, Farhan. I don't know this, but I am seeing signs of fatigue. Like, I wonder if this...
Week four, Harm. Week four. Game four, I should say.
Well, yeah. He's again, and that's where you're hoping it's partially because of the illness, right? And him getting back into game shape, that you have to hope that, because the way, like, right now I'm looking at him and I'm going, if this is the way he's playing, you can't play him 27 minutes a night. You've got to bring it down closer to 24-25, because even watching him defensively, like, I can't remember who it was that scored on that play, but it was one of the third period goals against the Capitals where Hughes was defending and it was on the back door and it was a rush chance. And it was like Hughes was just puck watching and he didn't even try turning around and he just looked so tired.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that's an issue. And even the interference penalty he took against Columbus in that third period where the Canucks were on the power play, that's just him not moving his feet and getting in the guy's way and setting that pick. And to me, I was just like, that's just a tired, lazy penalty to be taking. So
yeah, the Capitals player sold it, but Hughes put himself in that position.
Yeah, Columbus
last night. Yeah. Games are all mushing together, but yeah, he sold it. But yeah,
for like, sure, Hughes. But you can't take that penalty. You just can't. And so he looks like the 2021 version of himself, and the Canucks need to figure out how to get him back on track.
Yeah, I mean, is this the year, and we got to switch it to the house of positivity for a second. Is this the year that we get a Elias Pettersson last season version of Quinn Hughes, where the first half of the season he's nowhere to be found, and then by the time he figures it out, it's way too late. But on that vein, you know, as we talk about how the Canucks haven't been bad. They've had some really good moments in games, but they just can't manage it at the most critical time. Have they been good, or has Elias Pettersson just been good? Because Elias Pettersson is something else right now.
Well, he's definitely driving the bus for that. He is far and away the best player. He's on a completely different planet than everybody else on this team right now. And
the points aren't doing him justice, because his dominance is so much greater than his actual point totals.
100%. And he's doing it regardless of who's on his wing, right? This is a player who, against, I think it was Washington, is playing with Curtis Lazar, a fourth line grinder, and Andre Kuzmenko, who's just learning the ropes of the NHL. You could stick him at this point with me and you on his wings, and he'd somehow still be driving a 60% shot share and scoring all these points.
That's because I would have done all the work in the corners for him. I tell you though, I love him with Pod Colson.
Big physical body.
I love him with Pod Colson.
I do. And that's where, even with Pod Colson, and I don't mean to kind of go on a side tangent here, and kind of stop talking about Pettersson, but I'm seeing a different level of confidence with Pod Colson. Do you remember the dangle in the third period that he had driving the net through his legs? I'm like, oh my God, this guy's feeling himself. He's got swagger. And again, it just kind of goes back to he's getting more familiar. And I think I talked to Pod Colson for 15 minutes, amazing one-on-one interview on this road trip that I'm hoping to be able to drop when the team wins. So it isn't while the team's in crisis mode. But I think one area mentally that he's been trying to work on is trying to accept that it's okay to make an occasional mistake, right? That it's okay to try things, and that as long as the risk to reward makes sense, that he can take chances offensively. And the risk to reward element is huge, right? Because you don't want to be like JT Miller has been the last few games, where he's trying everything and there is no assessment of risk to reward. But in Paul Colson's case, that type of net front drive, that's the exact sort of chance I want him taking. And I think he's getting comfortable with that because he feels more established. He's got a more consistent lineup spot. And even as a playmaker, watching him in the first few games, against Edmonton, the way he was making plays off the wall and setting up Horvat in the slot, and against Philly, the assist that he had on Garland's goal and the patience, that's, to me, so far, Pod Colson's one of the underrated bright spots for this team so far.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. I think that I don't think we're in any danger of a sophomore slump with Pod Colson the way he's playing right now. Let's get into Bruce Boudreau in all of this. Earlier in the trip, he talked about the team being mentally weak. We'll get into the Connor Garland stuff in a minute, but four games into the season, can it possibly be that Bruce Boudreau is actually on the hot seat and is actually currently now, October 19th, coaching for his job?
I think that could absolutely be fair to say. And the reason I say that is, two reasons. Number one, we've just never gotten the sense that he's management's guy, right? Patrick Alvin didn't hire him. And if Rutherford and Alvin really believed in Boudreau, they would have looked at the second half of last season while the team's on cloud nine, and why would you not extend him? Whereas Boudreau, it was only an option. He could have, if he wanted, fielded other offers and accepted a job elsewhere. So the fact that they didn't extend him, even if it was a short-term thing beyond this season, especially when you know the pressure that comes with being a lame duck coach in a Canadian market, that to me was telling. Now, the other thing too is, Elliot Friedman, I think, mentioned on his 32 Thoughts podcast that management last offseason was toying with the idea of a coaching change last offseason. Again, that's when this team was on cloud nine after Boudreau. Nobody thought, hey, is Boudreau the right guy? Everyone just assumed with the way that he'd worked for this team and the way that the players were speaking glowingly about him, that he should be the guy. Boudreau had earned every right. And eventually, of course, they did turn in that direction. But the fact that they even considered it at any point, the fact that it even crossed their mind, to me is really surprising and says a lot. And the other thing too is, again, we heard Friedman as well on Donnie and Dolly say that he is sort of, I can't remember exactly what he said, but sort of insinuating that, yeah, he may be on the hot seat. And I'll tell you, an insider like Elliott, he's not saying that if he, like, he's just not throwing that out willy-nilly. Like that, like everything an insider says on national level is calculated, and everything we've heard to this point and all the senses that we have gotten are that he isn't necessarily management's guy. So, I mean, I don't know how short the leash is, but 0-3-1 with the way that they're blowing leads right now, boy, Boudreaux, in my eyes, has to be on the hot seat, even though I don't think it's his fault at all.
No, I know. And this is the challenge, is the roster is still flawed. But the problem is it looks so much like it did a year ago. Because when you see what happens in the third period of these games, the structural problems that management was critical of that aren't there for two periods completely rear their ugly heads in the third period of games. And so now you get to hang that on him again. The mentally weak comments, does that help him or hurt him, both in the room and as it relates to management and any potential decision?
Well, he's just being honest, right?
For sure.
There's always been a straight shooter. And I mean, I do think part of it is, look, you got to wake the guys up. And I mean, I don't necessarily view that as particularly positive or negative. I mean, I don't think by saying that, for example, that all of a sudden it's creating a sense that he doesn't have control of this team or that he can't prepare them adequately. I mean, I just can't get over the fact that when we have this conversation about Boudreaux, what difference is another coaching change going to make? Like, yeah, we're talking about, for instance, team is the team. And look, we're talking about horrific third periods this season. Last season, we were micro-analyzing horrific first periods. Maybe this isn't a mental block of, oh, they can't handle leads, or, oh, they can't start on time. Maybe we're just missing the forest for the trees. And maybe this just isn't a good team.
But the last 57 games of last season tell you what? That they just stood on the goaltender's head that the goaltender stood on his head, because we all know that in the last 2 months of the season, the goaltender was average when he was dealing with an injury and certainly was being overplayed. So certainly those 57 games are still seared in not only the fans' minds, but in management's minds. And they believe there's more there, even if we believe that Boudreaux may have gotten everything out of them to get to that point.
57 games is only 57 games, though. And there's a difference, because
it's more than four.
In my mind, but we also have they're not as bad. They're obviously not as bad as they were through these first four games. They're obviously not as bad as they were at the start of last season. But I think we all knew they're also not as good as they were through those 57 games in Boudreaux. And the key difference is when they had that run under him, there was no pressure. There was nothing to lose. They were already at rock bottom. Everybody had counted them out. It looked practically impossible for them to make the playoffs. I mean, at that point, if you start, like, there's zero pressure on this group, it's way different than heading into this season. And now all of a sudden you've got pressure. You've got expectations. And the standard, the bar, is you have to make the playoffs. I mean, a lot of people can thrive when there's no heat, when nobody's expecting anything out of you. So to me, I look at that as a difference too, where, again, we had all counted them out when the coaching change was made. And let's be honest, when there's no weight, when there's no pressure, there's nothing mentally weighing on you to go on the kind of run that they did.
Yeah, I know you're not wrong. And so now they're dealing with it. And one other thing on Bruce before we go to break, and that's the Connor Garland decision last night. Interesting. Because he has not been noticeably any level of problem with this team. Like, I'm not telling you he's played perfect, but you can't look at him with the same level of jaundiced eye that we're looking right now at JT Miller and others. And then Bruce said afterwards that everyone's got to be accountable, but he did concede that there are other players that, you know, haven't been playing well. When you take a veteran like Connor Garland and you scratch him, that's dangerous, because you've got a team that's completely underachieving. You have multiple players not named Elias Pettersson and Podkolzin that are underachieving. So are you going to hold all of them to the same level of account? And if you don't, you now get a veteran player that's now going to be very quickly is going to be sour. And you don't want that permeating in the room, unless you think he's going to get traded tomorrow. And this certainly wouldn't help his trade case. really, really curious to me, and I don't expect him to be scratched tomorrow. I expect to see Connor Garland in the lineup, and maybe Dakota Joshua, who's done nothing so far for this team, is probably the more logical guy to be sitting at this point. But I don't get it on so many levels. Like, what did he do that, you know, I'm not telling he was playing great, but what did he do that he needed to be held accountable for? And are you going to hold other veteran players to the same standard?
Yeah, I was really surprised by that decision. He hasn't been on the ice for a single 5-on-5 goal against. Like, and I get it, right? He's only got the one goal in three games, and he's only got four shots. But with Garland, the one thing I was wondering was, and this is just me thinking out loud, I definitely don't know this, but and Bruce definitely isn't tipping his hand, but I wondered, looking at the situation, if Boudreau thought about, okay, well, I want to sit one of the veterans to send a message, but I have to do it in a way where he doesn't want to take an essential piece out of the lineup in his eyes. And perhaps he looked at, because Hoglander had a really strong, high energy performance against the Capitals, I wonder if he looks at the similarities between Hoglander and Garland, and obviously Garland's a much better player, but the similarities of, okay, they're both high motor, undersized guys who are elusive with their edge work, kind of play a pretty similar style. I wonder if you looked at that and said, well, I can't take Hoglander out. Maybe Garland satisfies that criteria where he's a big name veteran where his absence would send a message to the locker room, to the top players, to get your crap together. But simultaneously, he's non-essential enough to where you can take him out for one game and not worry about how you have to replace his role on the lineup, knowing that Hoglander can play a similar style. That's the only thing I could kind of think of, but even then, it's not something that I necessarily agree with.
Yeah, like I said, I just think a player like that, and you're right, he's not as essential as a Horvat or a Miller or a Pettersson or a Hughes, who you're just never going to do that to. But when you can make the case that defensively, JT Miller has been by far the worst Canuck. Relative to ice time, matchups, importance, all of it, he has been by far the worst Canuck. And you can't even have the discussion there. So if I'm Connor Garland, I'm probably pretty sour.
Oh, I would be too. 100%. I'd feel picked on. I'd be going, why me? Why me when the whole team's been underperforming?
When we come back, let's talk a bit about the penalty killing, goaltending, and where it's at right now, and a surprise return from Tyler Myers. So, Harm, where do we start with the PK? Like, I know that JT Miller being out there with the first forward pair in most penalty kill has not been a good solution. We didn't see as much of that last night. We saw more of Elias Pettersson and Bo Horvat together. Mikheyev got added, but ultimately they still gave one up. And here we are, a team four games into the season that's operating at 50% on the penalty kill.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue that I see with the penalty kill, and there are a lot of them, is that quite simply they lack an elite penalty killing center. And the reason I say that is there are two traits you need that are essential for being a high-end penalty killing pivot. And that to me are, you've got to be good in the face-off circle, because face-offs may not matter a ton at 5-on-5, but shorthanded, if you win that initial draw, you're clearing it, you're killing 20 seconds, and regrouping and entering the offensive zone with control and getting set up again, that's hard to do. That's often a power play's hardest goal to accomplish. Whereas if you're losing every draw, you're just giving them a freebie to get set up. That's the issue that we had with Dickinson last season, for example. So you need good face-off ability, and then you need to be smart in zone. You need to be disruptive. You need to be a step ahead in terms of reading how the power play is thinking and where they might move the puck next. You've got to be able to quickly read. Because you're a man short, it's not just about covering a guy. It's about figuring out what's the most dangerous threat in a given situation. And with those two criteria, I can't name a single centerman, right? Because you look at Curtis Lazar, for example, 0-for-6 on faceoffs right now, shorthanded, and going into the Columbus game at least. And you look back at his career, I was curious. So I look back at his career shorthanded faceoff numbers. It's been around like a 36% guy at 4-on-5. So that's concerning to me. I still think he can help, and he's not going to go 0-for-6. he'll improve, but he doesn't satisfy that criteria. Elias Pettersson is probably their smartest in terms of how he reads. And because he's a power play guy, he understands how an opposing man advantage thinks. And he's just so good in zone, but he's not great in the faceoff circle. Then you look at Bo Horvat and JT Miller, they can win draws, especially Bo, but in zone, they're just not smart and aware defensively. So it's a really tough spot to be in. And I think that's why perhaps Boudreau looked at Horvat and Pettersson and went, okay, what if I pair my best faceoff man, even if he's a below average penalty killer overall, with my smartest in-zone defender? And maybe that's a combination that could work. And we saw some early dividends, but Boudreau doesn't have a lot of great options right now, if I'm being totally honest. Mikheyev coming in should help. He's going to kind of have, in my opinion, Tyler Motte type impact shorthanded, where it's like his speed and his disruptiveness, like they need him to be an ace and he could have a significant impact. But boy, it's been ugly so far.
Yeah, I mean, what did you take from the small sample size we saw of Mikheyev?
I was more fixated, honestly, on his 5-on-5 game.
Yeah,
I've got to be honest, I didn't really get to key in on his penalty killing impact super closely. In that game, I was kind of just more focused on the overall formation. But and having said that, you look at Mikheyev's overall track record. He was an excellent penalty killer in Toronto, and it's not just the way that he kills that he kills, but it's also he's dangerous in the sense that if you're an opposition defenseman and you're manning the point, if you screw up, Mikheyev's—he's off to the races. He's going to burn you on a breakaway, and Mikheyev only has one shorthanded move, so that's where again he's kind of similar to Mott, where he might create a ton of breakaways, but we'll see how good the actual finishing is. But that matters, right? That helps a PK a lot. You think about how much Philadelphia and Edmonton's shorthanded goals just completely shifted the momentum. That single-handedly probably won those games for those teams.
Sure.
And so to add a counterattack threat like Mikheyev, I think it does make a legitimate impact. I still don't know, however, especially when you consider the back end pieces, if I genuinely don't know if they're going to have a competent PK. I was hopeful going into the season, but man, they haven't given us a lot of reasons to maintain that hope so far.
Well, and when the Canucks PK did kind of turn a bit of a corner midway through last season, a lot of that was on the goaltending. And your goaltender needs to be your best penalty killer. Most teams will tell you that. But as far as the Canucks are concerned, and I mean, it's been Thatcher Demko mostly for three games. Thatcher Demko's made some big time saves in every one of those games. But his overall body of work on a 60-minute basis, night in and night out, is not what it was a year ago. Sometimes it's tough to say, look, that, you know, you shouldn't be leaning on a guy that much, but that's who they have. And a lot of what they've built has been based on that. So where are we with Thatcher Demko's game right now as you see it?
He's been average. That's the truth of the matter. But there are two things to keep in mind. For starters, you look at the tape on a lot of the goals that he's allowed. I think, for example, in the Edmonton game, so many of those goals were situations where it's like he didn't even have a chance based off the cross-seam movement. The backdoor plays, you think back to, for example, again, I'm citing the Edmonton example. The second power play goal that the Oilers had was just a perfect passing sequence. He had no chance. The Darnell Nurse goal was a 3-on-1 where it was a perfect cross seam pass. Against Washington, you look at there were a couple ones that I thought were a little bit soft, but the Canucks were also just completely leaving the back door open. It's interesting because on the whole, it's not as if the Canucks are just bleeding chance after chance. It's just that when they do break down, it's a colossal breakdown where oftentimes it's left Demko or in Martin's case last night. Again, you go back to the Werenski tying goal is a perfect example. It's like the goalie had no chance on that. And I don't think that a lot of people have brought up the goals saved above expected numbers and, oh, look, Demko's been negative. I don't know if that's fair because it doesn't take into account the pre-shot movement. I don't think it bakes in just how bad Vancouver's breakdowns have been on the occasions where they have had these lapses.
But those generally don't, you know, they generally fall into expected goals, right? I mean, there's been this, you know, there was a 7-hole goal against Washington. He kicked the first goal into his own net, essentially against Ovechkin on the power play, right? Like he made the save and, you know, I don't know if it was a knuckleball or whatever, or how the shot hit his pad, but eventually kicked it into his own net. There's been a few that he's had an opportunity to make those saves at key times.
For sure. And that's why I said he's been average, right? Like, and this is where on the last podcast, when we were talking about the bull and potential bear cases for making the playoffs, that's why I cited Demko as like, goaltenders are volatile. Yeah, and it doesn't matter how good you are. Doesn't matter if you're Carey Price, doesn't matter if you're Connor Hellebuyck, but goalies will have years where they're not superhuman. And I'm not saying Demko is going to play at this sort of average of a level. But again, that's why I said, even if he goes from elite to just merely good, that could have a massive downward pressure effect on the Canucks because he was so unbelievably good. And you can't expect that year in, year out on a consistent basis. It just, again, doesn't matter what your name is, doesn't matter who you are in this league as a goaltender, it doesn't happen. And that's always a risk. So yeah, Demko needs to be better. He needs to be better, right?
The challenge right now, though, is this team scoring goals, right? Like, it's not, you can't expect to win games 1-0 every night. Offense has not been the issue for this team.
Yep. But it also comes down to, like, you can't make these Bush League, you can't have these Bush League breakdowns. Like, it's both things. Yeah, Demko needs to be better. If Demko plays like this, the rest of the season, there's no way they make the playoffs.
No, you're right.
It just won't happen.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to have a balanced, nuanced take where I don't think it's fair to dump a lot of this on Demko and say, well, he needs to be better, and then the goals against numbers will go way down, and that's our recipe for winning, because it's not as simple as that. The team in front of him also has to look. They're going to allow a lot of shots. They're going to allow sort of a lot of B plus chances. You just can't allow the A plus chances where it's like, this guy had no chance. So it's both, I think, is kind of the point that I'm trying to make.
No, you're not wrong. And nobody's suggesting that Thatcher Demko is responsible for any of the four losses, especially the one he didn't play in last night. But I'm not suggesting he's responsible. I'm just saying that I think the
I agree with the overall point.
The players themselves are probably expecting, they're never going to own that, but I won't even say expecting, but just used to a little bit better from their goaltending, right? Like, that's just been the way it is.
But teams don't do that, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, they need that, but
the Canucks need it.
We're looking at that.
The Canucks, yeah. Even with Demko playing the way he did last year, the Canucks as a team needed to be better. And offensively, they are that, right? So they're, you know, and it's not like they didn't give up the A-plus chances a year ago. So somehow that puzzle is not fitting based on the timing of the goals, based on, you know, the goaltending hasn't been as good. The team's giving the goaltender more goal support. There's been egregious chances allowed this year, just like there was last year. So somewhere in all of that, goaltending has its own piece, and you can't hang it on the goalie. You can't, because Thatcher Demko, in no game has he been bad. In no game has he been the reason they've lost. But he certainly hasn't been the reason they would have won, right? Like, because there were games last year where he was the reason they won, and that hasn't happened
yet. He's a non-factor, I think, is the best way to say it. It's like a non-factor on both ends of the ledger, whereas he was their best player last season.
Tyler Myers coming back early. I know they had talked 2 to 4 weeks, and certainly closer to the 2-week number. And they threw him in. Like, he played a lot of minutes last night, played in every situation last night. 22-12 was his time on the ice, 115 shorthanded. They didn't take a lot of penalties. But what was your takeaway from his game? Is it just Tyler Myers, the same guy we're used to seeing all the time?
Yeah, I was impressed at how he managed that workload, considering it was just his first game back from injury. I thought it was a typical Tyler Myers game. I thought there was more good than there was bad. And it's just funny to me that it's true. There's 100% truth in it when we talk about Myers as if he's a savior for the back end. But it's just funny to me that he has to be a savior on this back end in the first place.
Yeah, but the thing with Tyler Myers is not that anybody expects him to be a savior in and of himself, but with the amount of minutes he logs, he puts other players in a better position to succeed.
I agree. And it takes a certain quality of a player to, for example, like he's never been a world beater when he's had to play these heavy, difficult top 4 minutes, but he's been competent. And there aren't a lot of, like, you can't just take a Kyle Burrows, for example, and he's played his heart out, but you can't just take a Kyle Burrows or a Tucker Poolman, thrust him into a top four role like that, and expect that they're going to be competent for long stretches at a time. They may give you a few games here and there where they're okay, but the solidity that Myers gives you is necessary for this team. And they need him to kind of be the player that he was. They need him and OEL to be the players that they were last season. And it's just, for better or worse, they're really reliant on him and OEL as a couple of veterans, which is a little bit unfair because they're being asked to do too much, but that's just the reality of the situation.
It is, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around defensive pairing and deployment because they need to get back to Luke Shen playing with Hughes. Like, OEL Myers, I thought was solid enough, but forget trying to balance these pairs, especially if you're going to give Hughes heavy minutes. If you're going to give Hughes heavy minutes, then you're probably better off letting him play with Luke Shen, the one defensively responsible player who can cover up for some of those mistakes. Like, I've seen all I need to see from Riley Stillman. Like, I don't know that he's going to be an upgrade today over Jack Rathbone. Jack Rathbone needs to get an opportunity to play. You need to have a little more skating and transition ability on the back end because Riley Stillman is not a defensive difference maker for them. And whether you play limited minutes with Rathbone alongside of Poolman, or you wind up putting him with Shen for certain moments in the game to just let him get his feet wet, four games in, everything was set up for Jack Rathbone to play. These are the moments that make you think Bruce Boudreau is coaching in the now, that this young guy doesn't get an opportunity to play. And Riley Stillman, who they acquired, at the last moment, is all of a sudden getting this kind of opportunity. Luke Shen played 14-20 last night. He was the second lowest in terms of minutes played when he's arguably your best defensive defenseman. The way this entire group is being deployed, and it's limited to begin with, I'm still trying to wrap my head around.
And it said a lot that Juulsen was called up and got into the lineup ahead of Rathbone.
And I get he's a right shot. Lot. He's a right shot, but he's not good enough.
But he's not. And he cost you that tying goal with turning the puck over twice in that manner before, I think it was John Carlson scored Washington's fourth goal. I think that says a lot about how much the lack of trust I think Boudreau has in Rathbone's defensive game. And look, I don't think Rathbone did himself any favors with that, the ending towards the preseason that he had with his puck management. And I think with Boudreau entering the last year of his contract and the team starting the way it has, and this is, I think, the case for a lot of NHL coaches, the difference between Stillman and Rathbone is that Stillman is, he may be an unspectacular player and he's just a 6'7", but you at least know exactly what you're going to get out of him. And he hasn't had catastrophic sort of breakdowns. With Rathbone, he's a higher risk, higher reward option where there are two different scenarios, two different paths for how drawing him into the lineup could work. He could draw in and immediately be a difference maker and a significant upgrade on Stillman with his puck moving, with the skating. But the flip side of it is you're rolling the dice where, especially now that he hasn't played in a while and you're immediately throwing him into the fire, there's also the chance that he could be overwhelmed. And you think back to last season, for example, the start that Rathbone had under Green, there were moments that he was overwhelmed. And I agree, he's earned a shot. I would have wanted him to get into the lineup ahead of Juulsen for sure. But you can understand, I think a lot of coaches would think in similar terms where Stillman's a safer option, Rathbone's an unknown, and you're a coach that's entering the last year of a contract and the team's in crisis mode.
Yeah, I just don't think Stillman is enough of an established player that you can make that case around, right? I mean, he's not proven himself to be a full-time NHLer. So you know,
honestly, he hasn't screwed up in a major way though. Like, he's fine. He's been fine on a bottom pair. Again, I agree. Like, I personally would have played Rathbone in that Washington game over Juulsen. I disagreed with Boudreaux's decision there, but I can 100% see I can understand the logic behind why Steelman's consistently gotten look, because he's been pretty sturdy and reliable.
Yeah, I suppose. I minus two the other night, I think that they can still get some more out of that pair. And sometimes, like, what was always the strength of Quinn Hughes? It wasn't necessarily his ability to defend. It was his ability to possess the puck and to move it and get it out of harm's way and not have to play in his own end. And I think Rathbone can give you a little bit of that, you know, 13 minutes a night. I'd be comfortable seeing Jack Rathbone at this point, as opposed to the chances you've taken with a guy like Noah Juulsen and all of that, right? So, you know, I look at it, I see the deployment, and I guess we're done for the entire year now, especially with Boudreaux talking about lefties and righties and, you know, playing on their handedness. We're never going to talk about Quinn Hughes playing the right side again, are we?
I hope not. I mean, last thing we need at this point is for him to be put in an even more challenging position.
But it felt like that was one of the best paths for Rathbone to get into the lineup.
Yeah, but I don't think you want to screw around with Hughes.
I agree with you. I agree with you, but I just hope that there is, because we still haven't seen Travis Dermott back.
Yeah.
And how much more difficult is it going to be to get Rathbone in the lineup at that point? Because Dermott's supposed to be back any day now.
A lot more difficult, because Dermott brings the same similar skating and puck moving, but he's way more established as an NHL piece. And he has, for years now, driven at decent to strong results in a third pair role, which Rathbone hasn't proven to this point.
Well, you can't prove it if you don't get a chance to play. And at some point, they're going to have to let him have the opportunity to prove it, given what they're paying him, given where he stands in the organization, and the lack of overall depth therein. Get Rathbone in the game. Is he the solution to why they're 0-3-1? No, but he can help, and it's time. And when you don't, you feel like you're a coach stuck in the now, fighting for your job, and everybody around you can see it.
Yeah. I agree. You've got to give him a shot soon, even though I've kind of been playing devil's advocate and I can see the logic behind why he hasn't gotten it.
Come on, you're a young guy. We elevated you to front line on the VanCast. You are 1C on the VanCast. I'm a measly 2C. So
no.
If you can do it, Jack Rathbone can do it. He can be a third pair defenseman.
Well, the VanCast also wasn't in crisis mode, nor are the executives at The Athletic entering the final years of their contract and potentially making decisions for their job.
Hey, we open the season with you in the lineup, bottom line. Anyway, listen, that's it for this episode of the VanCast. Subscribe to The Athletic Hockey Show on YouTube if you are looking for more pod options. Rob Pizzo, Michael Russo, and Jesse Granger will welcome Carolina Hurricanes broadcaster Tripp Tracy to the Athletic Hockey Show podcast on Wednesday. And as we mentioned earlier, Drancher and I will have a live room post-game podcast Thursday after the Canucks Wild game. Will we be talking about a first victory, or will we be talking about a team coming home in just beyond panic mode? Hopefully they can stem the bleeding, and we can talk about a win on Thursday night. We'll see about that. As for us, thanks for listening to the VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Subscribe. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. And this offer still remains. You can get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. Harm, one more stop on your trip. Try to have a good time, would you?
I'll try.
Minnesota, Wild City for Harmon. We'll see you next week.